Welcome to Season 2 of The Wayfarer's Guide to World Building, a podcast for writers by Mythos & Inc. Publishing. I'm Kyle.
I'm Emma.
I'm Allison.
And I'm Christiana.
Welcome. Today's trope is the plants have risen up against us, also known as dangerous and intelligent flora. Special thanks to our patrons for making this episode possible. If you're a patron, send us your writing, world building, or publishing questions for us to answer in our bonus Q&A episodes, which we record as a thank you to our Patreon supporters. There's something sinister about your surroundings trying to kill you, especially when those surroundings include giant human-eating plants, trees that try to smother you with their roots, or other dangerous flora. Guns, swords, and sometimes even fire aren't effective against shrewd shrubbery. I'm Christiana, they, them, public relations director at Mythos & Inc. And with me today is...
I'm Emma, she, her, editor at Mythos & Inc.
I'm Kyle, he, him, business and marketing director at Mythos & Inc.
So Kyle, what's your example?
Ooh, I get to go first?
Yes.
Okay, I'll have to describe a scene for you. So picture this, the night before... there was a huge thunderstorm. You managed to make it through the night. You're mostly dry, but as you're wandering your way through the forest, you and your party are stepping on the moist ground. You're feeling the twigs kind of crinkle beneath your feet. And just as you're coming to what you think is a clearing, you hear from behind you, the leaves, the trees start to rustle. You look back at the ranger and you see him take one finger and put it over his lips, telling you to shush. He slips away into it, decides to try and investigate what is making this noise. He looks a little further and doesn't see anything through the trees. There's no animal to see through this. What is making the noise? And it's a little too late for him to notice that it wasn't through the trees, but the tree itself. And then the DM says, roll initiative.
Dun, dun, dun. Oh. Dun, dun, dun. Kyle, have you ever DM'd?
Oh, yeah, totally.
that was a very DM description. Thank you.
I think those are the basics. I was really struggling to find like dangerous plants because like the only thing my brain would go to would have been like poison ivy in the DC universe, but she's not a plant. Right. Like she's an eco-terrorist, like, and she can control. But yeah, so I was trying to think, and then I thought about D&D. One of my favorite D&D monsters has some really fun lore around it, both in and outside. And it's called a shambling mound. So the history of a shambling mound is it's this phenomenon of like roots and vegetation that has been struck by lightning or some sort of magic that invigorates an otherwise normal, ordinary plant. It comes to life, as it were. Now, as it's born into its second life, it starts to engulf the things around it. It chokes life from other plants and even sometimes other animals around it. And it takes the corpses of these things and mulches them inside itself for food. Eventually, it has mulched enough that it no longer has to have roots into the ground. And this is where the shambling part starts to come in. And it moves slowly through forests, just engulfing everything and making itself bigger and bigger and bigger throughout its existence. And this is one of the most fascinating creatures, and why I think it's really fun world building is because in D&D, if you've ever been a part of a D&D campaign, is there are always those players that have memorized the monster manual, or at least they have some idea of what to do. And I have not been able to confirm for sure if this is true about the history of the Shambling Mound, but this is what is believed to be true when it was first made. So this is a monster that was created by Gary Gygax, one of the, you know, the original creator of D&D, etc., and had players in his game that always seemed to like, oh well, it's a plant, so what do you use to kill a plant?
Fire.
Exactly. Yeah. Right, fire, that would be the thing. And so he decided, he's like, I'm going to trick my players. And he creates the shambling mound. Of course, his players do the first thing that they would think is cast a fire spell. And they notice this thing is so moist from all of like the mulch and all of the engulfing of this, it's resistant to fire.
No.
And so they're like, okay. So then the players are like, all right. So, and this is normal in a lot of D&D conversations. The next thing you use is cold. So let's throw ice at it. Let's freeze it in place. Plants don't like the cold. And this generates so much heat from all of the stuff that it has engulfed, it actually repels all the cold and is resistant. And so the players are left being like, now what do we do with this giant plant that's coming? I know what we'll do. We'll cast lightning. Lightning always works. And that was the trick that Gary Gygax insisted, because not only is it resistant to lightning, not only is it immune to lightning, but lightning actually heals it and allows it to swallow more plants and get bigger. And so the reason why I think this is good world building is because it wasn't just like originally, if it were created this way, it was created to troll essentially his players. Like they're figuring everything out. They're thinking about these things. How can I create a monster that is believable, but will still have the reader or the engager or the person who is participating in this story go through that same thought process? Fire, cold, lightning, oh no. Like that was the whole story he wanted to tell.
Uh-huh.
And he built the history of an entire creature just to get that reaction, and successfully did so. So yeah, that's the Shambling Mound in Dungeons and Dragons and why I think it's good world building.
That's great.
I love it. I mentioned in the last episode that I do government communications, but more specifically, I do it for the park system. And so I have a lot of conversations and long days about wildfires and all these things about plants and ecosystems and conservation and stuff. So if you had me in your team when you were DM, I would say, is there a way to erode the soil around the roots? Because that is one of the Ooh. Largest issues when it comes to plant conservation. But that's super interesting. So does it have a weakness?
Okay. Technically, according to the game, it does not have a weakness. You basically just need to beat this thing down and eventually you get through it. It's really strong. It's got a lot of hit points. It's got a huge amount of armor. But eventually you get there. Like, it can only do certain things. Once you've kind of like realized, oh, it's resistant to these things and it absorbs this thing, that's it. There's no real more story to this thing.
We just got to send in a guy with a plaid shirt and an axe. And
yeah, that's pretty much it. We call those people barbarians and we're good to go.
Yes.
The lumberjacks are the Canadian barbarians of the D&D world. It's true.
Yes.
So I play a ranger in my current D&D campaign, and he would absolutely love to encounter a shambling mound. Now, do shambling mounds have strict alignments? Do they have to be good or do they have to be evil? Or is there a way to befriend and or domesticate one?
A domesticated shambling mound.
Right? The wheels are turning.
That's very fair. And these technically are neither good nor evil. They would be considered unaligned. So they don't have any allegiance. They're just hungry beasts, essentially. Typically,
reacting,
they don't exist
environment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, they don't exist in a society. It's not like the shambling mound.
There's no government, like, of
none of that. No. Yeah, the society of the shambling mounds, that's what their official term would have been. But they're more like the lone wolves or things like that. So there are some like animal style characteristics that you would have to overcome, right? Like, this is about hunger, this is about distrust. They're acting on their own. However, there are various creatures in the D&D realms called like tree spawn or vine spawn, which are essentially more humanoidish type creatures coming out of trees and vines, etc. Kind of your dryads. Like, they do have like a kindness to one another. They kind of recognize each other as such things. And there are stories and there have been adventures where they use shambling mounds as defenders for their ill or elderly or powerful or even as used as powerful foot soldiers. So if your ranger has like that druidic, you know, fey magic background that could maybe tap into it, if you get the right DM, I don't see why not.
My DM's gonna be so mad at you. I'm blaming Kyle for when I.
You're practically writing notes right now.
Next session.
Find
the shambling mounds.
The shambling mounds. I'd like to spend 10 minutes doing perception to find a shambling mound, please. All right. But so my example, of course, is also about some dangerous plants, but they're a little differently dangerous. So my example is coming from Alice Through the Looking Glass and What She Found There, I believe is the full title. It is the sequel to Alice in Wonderland, which sadly not many people know about. It's not as popular as the original, but I love it. I've actually listened to it. I used to listen to it as a kid. I listened to it on audiobook every night and actually helped me fall asleep because it was so like comforting. So I've listened to this thing like a million times, but so it has a very special place in my heart. But there is a section where there are flowers. So Alice is, she has gone, the premise of the book is she goes through a mirror and ends up in this topsy-turvy mirror land. Everything is opposite to how it would be in real life. It's just as kind of bizarre and quirky as Wonderland is. And at one point, Alice is trying to find her way around, and she keeps ending up in the same spot, even though she keeps going down all these different paths. So she goes up a hill to try and kind of get her bearings and see where she is. And as she's going up this hill, she sees a bunch of flowers, and she remarks to herself, oh, you know, it's too bad that flowers can't talk. And then, of course, the flowers talk. And the first thing that they say is, well, we do if there's anybody worth talking to. And they just continue to get ruder from there. They call her ugly. They say that she wouldn't make a very good flower. They call her stupid. So they're dangerous to perhaps the self-esteem or the ego rather than physically. But I just, and they don't play a very big role in the book. Like they just, they mentioned to her that the queen that Alice was looking for was in the garden earlier. And, you know, that's kind of it. It's not like they play a huge role in the story, but I love it because it's just such a juxtaposition of what we normally think flowers are going to be. And so I think it's really good world building because it really fits the theme of the book, which of course is, you know, everything turned on its head. So these flowers are just rude jerks instead of being, you know, delicate and nice. And it also showcases that world building doesn't have to be huge and monumental. You can just sprinkle in little tidbits that may or may not still advance the plots. And sometimes that's all a piece of world building needs to be. It just needs to be fun and weird. And then you can just keep on with your story. Not everything has to be a giant to do.
So I also love Alice in Wonderland. And I also love it for the same reason where you think of giving rose. I imagine giving roses to my spouse who I love very much. And then them being like, your hair looks stupid or something like that. That'd be very funny. So you kind of mentioned them giving out information. Are they information bearers? Like I imagine if you're going through a walk in a rose garden and having conversations, are they eavesdropping and then giving that information to other people?
You know, it kind of sounds like it. Now, I don't know how they gather this because like they call, they remark on Alice's appearance and that sort of thing. So it kind of implies that they have eyes of some sort and like yes, ears that they can see and hear things. I don't know how. They're not described as having like physical eyes. So, you know, that's just a thing. So yeah, it doesn't seem like they're necessarily huge gossips or that they're, you know, doing this spying on purpose, but it does definitely seem like they're aware of what's happening and they can tell you stuff that's going on. So, which is kind of interesting. Alice probably should have asked them more questions. Maybe she could have got some more answers, although they were kind of rude. So who knows what else they would have told her? No idea.
Well, I wonder if, are these, well, okay. I have to add in first, I'm also a massive fan of Alice in Wonderland. I love Lewis Carroll books. I don't know. It's really cool. I love Alice in Wonderland. It's funny that the three of us do. And it's like, oh, nobody else does.
No, everyone loves Alice in Wonderland in some way or another.
All of us in some way can relate to the Mad Hatter. That's, I think that's yeah, just, especially over the last 3 years, that's kind of our.
Uh-huh. Oh, everyone's yeah, mad here, for sure. Truly.
No, my thought is, for these flowers in particular, does their rudeness impact their value at all? Do people not like them in this Ooh, world, or do they like them even more because of their rude? Does that have any player impact?
I don't know. It's never like they are a very small piece, so they don't mm-hmm, really come up again. Right. I don't believe that Alice has a conversation with anybody about them. Now, it is interesting. Hold on. I'm actually just going to Google a piece of information real quick, make sure not saying anything wrong. 1 second, hold please.
Google, Google, Google.
I Google things all the time. I think Googling things in and of itself is a skill. In the meantime, I still really love the idea of flowers insulting people and like cutting right to the core. Yes. It's almost like, you know how when you talk to a kid and they like somehow can magically sense your biggest insecurity and then they say it out loud?
Yes.
Kyle, you have many kids. I'm sure you.
Oh, there are many a story that I'm not sure I'm allowed to tell. So
yes, I'm thinking that's what the flowers would be like. I'm thinking of my niece and nephew who once looked at my grandma and they're like, paper hands, grandma. Skin on the back of your hands looks like paper. And I was like, oh my God. even without social context, they just cut straight to the core.
So the house itself, I don't think we ever find out. So at the house that Alice enters when she goes to the Looking Glass is sort of the same version as her house on the other side, but sort of all flipped around. We never really find out who owns the house on the mirror side of it. So it could very well be that the person who planted all these flowers was like, you know, I hate people. I want people who come to my garden to have a bad time. Let me find the rudest flowers I possibly could. I'm going to actually headcanon that now that was the case, because there's something so delightful about somebody purposely being like, no, people just not leave. Have a good time here.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, but yeah, no, we never really find out what other people's perceptions of the flowers are. And I mean, it could also be like the flowers say that they don't talk to people unless there's somebody worth talking to. So it could also be that people just don't, the flowers don't deign right. to talk to anybody. So maybe nobody even knows that they can talk.
Yeah.
Lots of unanswered questions.
I wonder how it ties to Victorian flower language, because I think this is around the time. And I remember a very dear friend of mine, when they first started dating their spouse, they were really into like what color of roses have different meanings. Their future spouse gave them yellow roses, and yellow roses are the sign of friendship. And so they were kind of like, oh, these are like friendly roses, not like romantic roses kind of thing.
Meanwhile, nobody else knows how that much... and are just like, roses are romantic by their very nature.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny. I wonder how much that kind of flower language at the time influenced the writing of this.
I'm going to have to look that up, because there are a few different species of flowers that talk to Alice, like tiger lily, and I think there's some roses.
Yeah,
interesting.
So I'm going to have to see what the Victorian flower language is for them and if they correspond to the things the flowers are saying.
Are the yellow roses nicer? Is really our question.
Yeah.
And could there also be said that maybe all flowers do talk in real life, but we're none of us are just worth being talking to?
That's it.
There has been research that showed if you play like positive sounding music to plants in general, they grow better than if you blast heavy metal at them.
Fascinating.
Which I take personal offense to, because I listen to a lot of heavy metal, but
how are your plants doing in your home? Are they thriving?
Like to think they're doing great. I have like 25 house plants and they're all thriving. So
wow, good for you.
Impressive.
Yeah.
So my example is a very classic sci-fi example, and it is The Day of the Triffids.
Very nice.
Yeah, of course.
So The Day of the Triffids is a post-apocalyptic novel, and it covers the experience of people living through an apocalypse with deadly plants. So what happens in the beginning of the book is there's a meteor shower that anyone who viewed it becomes blind. And then after that, the Triffids appear, which are giant 7 to 8 feet tall plants. And they kind of, I describe them as kind of looking like really tall daffodils. They can walk slowly, but out of the middle of the daffodil, there's like a big, I'm blanking on the name of it, but the thing that comes out of the middle of a flower, but it's extra stamen? Long. This stamen, there you go. There's a big stamen out of the middle of the flower, but it's really long. It's like 10 feet long, and it can whip out like a whip. And if it hits you, it kills you. And then the Triffids will kind of crawl over to you and hang out by your dying body and sustain themselves off of the nutrients that come from your decaying body. It's a very
horrifying,
very, very grim concept. So there are these giant, terrifying triffids, and it's never super clear where the Triffids came from. In the novel, they don't explicitly say where they came from. There have been many movie and TV and radio adaptations since then. Mm-hmm. They all kind of have different ideas. Some people say that the original movie says like the Triffids came with the meteor shower. Some people say that it was like part of a Soviet scientific experiment and they got out. And there are so many different ideas of where they came from. But in the original story, there's no clear connection between the meteor shower and the Triffids. So now it is this post-apocalyptic world where a large portion of the population no longer has sight because of the meteor shower. And they're trying to make their way around these Triffids who are very quickly trying to kill you. And again, there's no discussion about why the Triffids are doing this. Is it natural instinct? Are they just there trying to feed themselves? And that is like a biological response to other living beings in their area, much like a Venus flytrap. When a fly touches a hair in its mouth, it closes its maw, kind of thing. Mm. So there's a lot up in the air about it. But it ends up with this post-apocalyptic world, and it kind of turns into a conversation about ableism, which I think is really interesting as a disabled person, where, you know, this novel was first published in the 50s, and the conversation of sighted versus unsighted in a post-apocalyptic world. So there are sighted people leading the unsighted, there are unsighted people leading their own things. There are people who think the unsighted people should be slaves or enslaved and, you know, do their agriculture. And it's a really, really tense and interesting book that I really enjoy. And I enjoy all the adaptations. And one thing that I really love about it is that the novel opens up with someone who's unsighted from the meteor waking up in a hospital, not being able to see what's going on, and having to figure out this post-apocalyptic world around them, which in turn actually was a big inspiration for 28 Days Later, which I think is one of the best zombie movies of all time. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of heavy influence in this. And what I think makes this, The Day of the Triffids, such a fantastic example of world building is that nothing is ever super clear, but the consequences are. What caused the meteor shower? Not clear. What caused the Triffids? Not clear. What exactly the Triffids can do? Pretty clear, but still never super solidified. And that uncertainty, I think, really creates a phenomenal world for these characters to interact with, because it's not an equation. It's not, oh, well, there's a Triffid. I do X, Y, Z, and I'll be fine. Kind of thing. Nothing is ever super clear. And I think that's part of what makes it so interesting. And also, as a disabled person, the conversation around disabilities in this universe and how they're either utilized or abused. Again, super interesting, especially for a novel coming from the 50s.
Totally. And I think that uncertainty probably makes it work really well as like a, I've never read it, but from the sounds of it, it would be a really good like horror thriller thing, because that's something that's terrifying, right? Is uncertainty. You don't know why this is happening or you know, that sort of thing. All you know is what's happening because of it, and it's awful, which I think is very effective if that's the kind of story you're trying to tell, for sure. Do the Triffids have any weaknesses, or how can they be defeated? Are they weak to, you know, lightning or ice or fire, or do you take a sledgehammer to them?
So it's been a long time since I've consumed this media. So I'll admit, I can't think of a weakness offhand other than the fact that they move fairly slowly. Hmm. Like they're described in the book as moving like someone on crutches. So realistically, you know, you could probably outrun them if you are able to run. And in the book, they do create like a safe hold, and they build these big fences or walls around their safe hold, and the Triffids are surrounding them, but they can't get in. Like they can't climb anything like that. So there are safe holds and there are ways to get around them. And I think the majority of that is like speed. Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of the weakness. And the novel ends on a very unclear note where it's, they, without getting into too much detail, ultimately they just kind of decide like, okay, we're safe for now, but eventually we're going to find a way to kill these Triffids and take our world back.
This the story of Triffids reminds me of what was that Sandra Bullock film on Netflix that took everybody by storm where everybody was blind?
Birds or something. It was something with birds. It wasn't that far off.
That's fair. Bird Bog. It reminds me of that because what I liked about that film was a lot about like this encountering of disability and what does that mean and what does that look like and how do we still work together despite it, et cetera, et cetera. It does that play into Triffids at all? What does that look like?
So in Bird Box, people with disabilities were given an advantage in the situation, whereas in with Day of the Triffids, they were disadvantaged. So people who were blinded by the meteor shower couldn't see the Triffids. They couldn't see what was coming to them. So even though they moved slowly and kind of shambled along, a shambling mound, if you will, they didn't have the same opportunity. So they, to some degree, relied on sighted people to guide them through the situation. And it's really interesting to see how it plays out in the book, because in the original novel, there are sighted people and non-sighted people who band together. And I hope that's the, like, that's the terminology that's used in the book. And I don't want to at all use the wrong terminology for people with vision.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So like I'm using those words because that's what's used in the book. I just want to make that clear. So there are sighted people and non-sighted people who kind of band together to protect each other. And even the non-sighted people are able to kind of operate in their environment and be very self-sustaining, but still to some extent, they're relying on sighted people to say, hey, there's a Triffid 50 feet away, right? That kind of thing. So they band together. And then in another safe spot, there's sighted people who are saying, we could see the Triffids, we could protect ourselves. There's so many non-sighted people because it's a huge portion of the population who saw this meteor shower and who then became blinded from it. So there's some safe areas where the sighted people are saying, we made this safe. We'll take in non-sighted people, but they have to farm for us. They have to take care of the agriculture. They have to do all these things, blah, blah, blah. And it's really ableist and gross and really frustrating. So I think it's an interesting novel because you see two sides of it. You see a safe area where sighted people and non-sighted people are treated the same. Like they're all just survivors and they're all trying to make it through this world that's very complicated. And then you see the kind of evil antagonist who's very much like, we saved you, so you owe us. It's really gross, but it's really interesting, especially considering it was written in the 50s, right? Like,
yeah, you don't expect that sort of commentary from that time period necessarily.
Yeah, like there's obviously still problems with it and obviously still like uncomfortable sentiments in it, but it's surprising. I would say it's surprisingly progressive from a book written in the 50s. So we've got a couple announcements before we get to the questions you should ask yourself if you decide to play with this trope in your novel. If you think this podcast is at least a dollar's worth of education and entertainment, consider supporting the show through Patreon at patreon.com/mythosandinc.
Using the magic of technology to pause time for just a moment here to ask a really important favor. If you're enjoying this podcast and want to hear more of it, the most helpful thing you can do is to write us a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to our podcast. Positive reviews are the number one way for a new podcast to get more listeners, which in turn will let us do all sorts of cool things like transcribe all our episodes and from recording bi-weekly to maybe even weekly. You can go leave us one right now. I promise I'll keep time paused until you get back.
So, concluding questions. What should you ask yourself if you have dangerous plants in your novel?
We all have a lot of expectations when it comes to this idea of plants and plant creatures, things that are standards. These are the things that all plants must do or have or engage with in some way, shape, or form. But what are some of the things that you can play with and change to maybe subvert your audience's expectations and take them on a journey that they didn't expect to go on?
I think my question would be, or maybe not necessarily question, but yeah, thing to think about would be, how are you going to lean into the things that make plants plants? So kind of the opposite of Kyle's question. So while you also want to make it unique, also, why not? Why are you not making it an animal? Why is it not an alien? What about it? Or what of plants' unique features can make your world building better or your creature better, that are kind of unique to plants and not animals? Does that sound okay? Should I rephrase that? That was kind of an awkwardly worded question.
No, that was a good question.
Okay.
My question would be, if your plants are physically harming people, how would disabilities play into that? Does that affect the story? Are they killing people on contact? Are they leaving them with barriers to access? And if so, how are those addressed? The hosts of Wayfarer's Guide to World Building are also creatives. At the end of each podcast episode, we share a little bit about what we've been up to off air. So Kyle, go ahead.
Oh man, what have I been up to? Parenting. That's really, we've got, it's spring break for the kiddos and I took the week off. And so all creativity is around what they're doing, which has included perfecting a leprechaun trap. Just putting that out there.
I've seen about those. They're fun.
So yeah. So my 6-year-old is intent on one day catching a leprechaun. So we've been experimenting.
Cute. I have been playing with a new keyboard. I got a really cool keyboard that looks like a typewriter keyboard, and it's mechanical, so it makes all the nice clickety-clacky noises. And as is the tradition, I'm still procrastinating on actually doing any writing, but I'm having a lot of fun picturing myself writing with my new keyboard. So that's my creative pursuits lately.
So what I've been up to is not excessively creative, given that I work a very busy job and am in grad school, but my spouse and I have been playing Elden Ring a lot lately.
Nice. Oh, you're one of those.
I'm one of them, which is interesting because he's never played a single Dark Souls game. And I've never been a big fan of Dark Souls games. I've played them. But I am a sucker for an opportunity to be a mage running around in an open world on a horse shooting magic at people. But it's been really fun playing the game and trying to decide what decisions our character would make. We're sharing one character and kind of like passing off. So sometimes we have discussions of like, would Seraphil make this decision though? Would Seraphil do this? Is this in Seraphil's character? That's been kind of a weird and fun exploration of character building where we decide together what our one character would do. So it's been kind of fun. If you're looking for a sci-fi and fantasy writing community on Discord, go to mythosinc.com and join ours. And if you have any questions, suggestions, comments, email us at podcast@mythosinc.com or tweet to us at @mythosandinc, all spelled out. Until next time, fellow wayfarers, go build worlds.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.